Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in History Podcast, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Christophe Odinets, and our guest today is Agnès de la Haye. She is a historian of colonial American history, specializing in 17th century New England, settler colonialism, and the history of enterprise. Her book is Settling the Good Land, Governance and Promotion in John Winthrop's New England. She has also published, I think I counted, 14 academic articles on New England history, and of course her doctoral dissertation on the individual and the community in John Winthrop's New England. Dr. de la Haye teaches at Lyon at the Université Lumière Lyon 2 and is a member of the interdisciplinary Triangle Research Group, which combines action, discourses, and economic and political thought to better understand the meaning of political ideas and consequences. Last year, she received the rank of habilitation to direct doctoral theses, the highest rank in the French system. Agnès de la Haye, welcome to the New Books in History podcast.
Thank you, Christophe. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Settling the Good Land is an exciting story of the newness of the New World and how these 17th century Englishmen first got interested in the project and then up and moved across the ocean to put their money and their lives where their mouth is. Would you tell us who these people were, these settlers of the Good Land, this new and emerging settler type, as you call them, and what is the scope and argument of your book?
Yes. So the settlers I studied were part of what is called the Great Migration of English colonists from England to America in the spring of 1630. About 700 people traveled with John Winthrop that particular spring, but eventually it is estimated that about 20,000 people traveled to the coast of New England in that decade. So these settlers were the beginners of English mass settlement on the American coasts. They were families, householders, and their dependents who came from various points across England, but in particular East Anglia, where John Winthrop himself was from. And they had gathered under the Massachusetts Bay Company, a colonial company, of very small colonial company, that had chosen settlement as a business plan to compensate for what had been colonial failures until then on the New England coast. I focused on John Winthrop because he is the central source, really, on the founding of New England. He is known mostly as the author of the Model of Christian Charity, extolled by many generations of antiquarians, genealogists, and historians as the first expression of a civil and providential vision of America, the world-famous City Upon a Hill. Now, the model is in every anthology of early American literature, which makes Winthrop a historical figure of major importance in American memory. His latest biographer, Francis Bremer, called him America's forgotten founding father in 2003. Now, in Settling the Good Land, I took a deliberately different approach. I was not so much concerned with the significance of his writing and policies in subsequent American history, Rather, I tried to understand what he knew or could have known about America and colonization in 1630. Why he had decided to join a colonial company at the very ripe old age of 41, which was ancient by the standards of those days, and also what understanding he had of his function as colonial governor, what governance in a colonial context actually entailed. In other words, I was interested in the context of his colonial career, not so much in his legacy, even though I addressed this issue in the last chapter of the book. How is it going? Is it good?
Yes, perfect. So who was this enterprising Englishman, the father of New England?
This the father of New England is a big word, but this enterprising Englishman was a lawyer and a lord of the manor of East Anglia. He was born in Groton, which is about 40 miles from Cambridge and 80 miles from London. And he was the firstborn of a secondborn landowner in the region. And he struggled in his childhood to reach full ownership of his family's land. Just like his father before him, he combined management of that holding spread out across East Anglia through marriages and purchases with a legal career in London, where he was a clerk practicing land law, recording and arguing conflicts of land ownership, wardships, and tenancies between aristocrats, between gentlemen and aristocrats, or between the middling sort of Englishmen and the crown. He was an expert in land law who, at the age of 41, had a sort of moral crisis and decided to put his tremendous clerical energy to the job of colonial governor. Now, if I can explain a little bit what I mean by this crisis.
Yes, please.
John Winthrop, he's a wonderful historical actor to study because he was a prolific writer. There are 5 volumes of the Winthrop Papers edited by the Massachusetts Historical Society in the early 20th century. He's written a journal, and through reading all these sources comes a very powerful voice. What struck me about him was his tremendous sense of self, which partly comes from his religion, but also from his political ambition. As I said before, he was a landowner and a lawyer in 17th century England, moving regularly from his land, 80 miles from London, to London, where he spent extensive periods in the Inns of Court, trying to rise up the social ladder available to the gentry at the time. And at many times in his youth, and he recorded this in his writings, his own sense of self and conviction was pitted against the authority and the glory of men above him. Men who had religion, just like he did, but had glory, had lineage, more land than he had. And this confrontation increased as time went by. He was a wonderful family man with many children, many boys especially, and limited land. His career in land law was meant to increase opportunities for social and financial advancement, which in 1629 were proving rather limited. His older sons, didn't have a calling, didn't really have a profession. And his second son, Henry, who tried his hand at settling, planting tobacco in Barbados, had come back to London and seduced his cousin under his uncle's nose, jeopardizing the reputation that Winthrop had spent his entire life building. by being an exemplary clerk, a loyal representative, a messenger for the different political circles in East Anglia and around London, someone people could trust. And when he was hired by the Massachusetts Bay Company, all the sources pointed to that reputation as an exemplary land lawyer, someone who was expert in managing land disputes, who understood property and who understood the privileges that came with that. It just so happened that at the age of 41, he had reached the limits of what English society could afford him. And he decided to leave for that reason, for opportunity. And the word sounds very contemporary and very modern, but it's actually all over English promotion at the time. The opportunity for something that Winthrop valued above all else, and that was competency, the opportunity to be independent, not to be dependent on anyone for income to live on, but also to pass on to one's children.
I really appreciate the psychological picture that you give us, and how he's cramped and he can't get out and achieve what he wants. And as you said, he had seven boys and could not provide for them in the old world. And that this word competency comes up many times in this text, and also liberty. But let me ask you something that was confusing to me, because this is for every American child. This is not a new subject. We have this in elementary school, but we don't have a complete picture. And so when I remember learning about the Pilgrims around Thanksgiving as a very young child, it was always about seeking freedom of religion as these Puritans. And indeed, Winthrop was a devout Puritan. But I was so surprised to see how he could thrive, or at least make his way in England at that time. And there's a quotation you give us from John Smith of Virginia on page 167, praising the chief undertakers of the Massachusetts Bay Company as gentlemen of good estates, some of 500, some of 1,000 pound of land a year, men of good credit, well-beloved in their country, and good Catholic Protestants, which means the Reformed Church of England, even though there were among them a few discontented Anabaptists, Papists, Puritans, Separatists, and such factious humorists. So why then does historiography cling to the image of the oppressed pilgrims in the wilderness finding a new safe haven to start a new society?
Well, it's a very appealing image. It's a very powerful idea of history moving in a certain direction towards more religion, towards more progress. It was repeated time and again over the 19th century by Romantic historians who described American history as a continuation of European history westward, and the focus on local agents of motivated by religious purity made sense in that romantic perspective at a time when the nation was trying to find commonality, experiences that individual Americans could look back on and find meaning in. In the 1950s, when Perry Miller established the Puritan paradigm of the errand of the Puritans into the wilderness, he established a tradition, a historiographic tradition, that required of historians to conceive of these experiences through the prism of Puritanism, because it was shared by people in Old and New England. So it connected both spaces, and it created a continuum of ideas, the progress of the Reformation from the Old World to the New World. But they focused essentially on religion as culture, Puritanism in New England studies is all pervasive. It explains everything from people's child rearing habits to what they ate to how they considered nature and the environment. I mean, there are hundreds of books about Puritanism in New England, and I read them as a student of American history, interested in colonial history. I read all these books, and all secondary sources seem to point to John Winthrop. He was quoted everywhere, and he represented power in that colony. So I decided to go and look for myself, and I was sitting one day in the British Library, in the rare books reading room at the British Library, with the 1996 Harvard edition of the journal, and I started reading it from page one. And suddenly, it was a revelation, I have to say. Suddenly, I encountered the world that, for a reason I couldn't explain then, religion had not described. A world of contest and struggle for land, for survival, for resources, that was worlds away from the expectations I had of what a Puritan society would be. Inward looking, pre-modern, and not interested in either trade or social change. And when I started reading the journal, I saw the opposite of that. I discovered a voice, someone who was witness to a series of events that were unprecedented in the history of English colonization. And I wanted to understand where he had built these expectations about colonization. So I started reading promotion, going back, reading English promotional texts, looking for representations of America, its landscape, its peoples, about what colonization meant and how to best organize and run it. And I found that actually promotional writers were anything but original. When England entered the race for American possession a century after the Spanish, there were many, many precedents of conquests and war, and some colonies had disappeared. A lot of business failure, a lot of business failure. And then I traced the idea of settlement, or the idea of a permanent appropriation of American land by English families, to the campaign by Sir Walter Raleigh in the mid-80s. He had agents and promoters, Richard Hakluyt the Elder and his nephew, Richard Hakluyt the Younger, who proposed that the key to England's imperial success would be to establish enough ports and trading posts in America to support the English fleet all year round as it competed at sea with other nations for Spanish treasure. The next step in this process was the founding, the creation of commercial companies in the 1610s under James I, and the pivotal role of John Smith in articulating the role of settlers in making England succeed, in spite of its considerable delay and the apparent neglect of its sovereign.
John and Smith, he's telling the truth. He's correct that this is a large group of people, some quite mainstream, but...
Yes, he's correct. And John Smith speaks from experience. I think most historians agree on how significant his writings on Virginia and later New England were. He basically described a hierarchy of agents of colonization. Investors in London stayed at home. They enjoyed the comfort of their chimney corners, quote unquote, which is a phrase that you see coming up again and again in promotion. While settlers risked life and limb to expand English sovereignty in America, they deserved proper reward for their efforts. Smith told again and again how he had been abandoned by the investors of the Virginia Company, betrayed by them when they realized that returns weren't coming quick enough. They just abandoned the settlers to their fate. Now, John Smith argued that those who chose colonization should reap the fruit of their labor. That is, have access to some form of full ownership of land in America and enough autonomy and self-government to fulfill their plans. So I believe this is a central moment in the history of settlement when John Smith actually argues that settlers are real and they are the only serious agents of colonization.
I think that's a very important point. And I'll just add that I was also surprised to learn from your book that the Pilgrims of the Mayflower were not sailing from Britain, but from the Netherlands, where they had been for some time. But they found it too decadent there, which I suppose one can find in the Netherlands to this day. But that they included ordinary adventurers, as you call them, some of them Leideners from there. And so even so, there weren't just this religious group. It was all kinds of people. But this brings me to a second question, which was also a surprise, perhaps as a third surprise already, is how much back and forth there is. I sort of imagined that these colonists came to this new world left alone, but in fact, they go. The reason they're doing all this promotional writing is for continual support from England. So how does this genre of promotional writing and the continuous reporting back to the investors, it really links... I mean, the Atlantic is a small body of water, but it links both coasts. And so New England keeps one foot in Old England. And that was an astonishing discovery from reading your text. Would you talk about that, that genre of writing and what it achieved and how much back and forth there was?
Yes. Colonization, I believe, it was a public act. You know, before land claims became real, they were first signified through maps that were transformed, added to, and circulated across Europe. Claiming possession of land in America only became real if other people could be informed of that phenomenon. So colonization was a public act. There were maps, but there were also narratives. Now, explorers and colonizers needed publicity to generate support. They needed support because even if they packed their ships full, they would only travel over with enough supplies to last them through one winter. They knew that over there, they would be completely destitute. So they needed people at home who could maintain their reputation to creditors and fill up the ships that came back with additional supplies or more laborers to help them build their settlements in America. So this was a relationship that was an essential part of the business. Men in England who wanted to invest in colonial ventures for whatever reason expected some form of return. They knew that returns weren't immediate. The average time of financial returns was about 7 years. So during these years, connections had to be maintained with merchants in England, captains who carried those goods back and forth across the ocean, and settlers themselves in New England who labored to fill the ships with timber and fish and anything that infer naturally that they could sell back in England to pay their creditors and buy more supplies.
Were those the chief items that traveled back to England? Timber, yes. Fish, and beaver pelt?
Yes, timber, fish, and beaver pelt. And but we shouldn't think of New England trade as solely circulating between the Old World and the New. More immediately, New England ships traveled the American coasts and all the way to the Caribbean. And so very quickly from the mid-1630s, that is 5 years after the beginnings of settlement, Winthrop records in his journal that he received an alligator from a governor in Barbados. He mentions sugar and cotton and all sorts of goods that English and European colonists in general, not just English colonists, exchanged along the coast. So it's not just that settlers depend on people in England. They also depend on other colonizers and colonists along the coast, and they naturally depend also on the Indian trade. So instead of a closed up world, you know, the Puritans walking in the snow towards their church, you know, isolated in the wilderness and a hostile nature, that is not at all the picture that the journal gives. On the contrary, it describes a world that is open to absolutely all areas of the Atlantic world, including Africa. And Winthrop in particular cherished his relationships with his favorite captains who could be counted on to bring grain when there wasn't enough corn to eat, or to bring enough sugar for New England landowners to start making rum from the 1640s, and brag about how popular their rum was in Virginia in the Caribbean. So we really have to think of it as an open world, not a closed world on religion and the church.
That's very important. You mentioned maps. I love how many maps there are in your book, many of them in color. And I was looking at the map of Massachusetts Bay. I think it's on 189. And I lived there for 3 years. And it's interesting to see Newton as New Town, or Watertown as Watertown, or the Charles River. I remember going jogging there. What was it like 400 years ago in 1631 when Winthrop got off of his ship? And what did he find? What did it look like? How did it, what kind of a world should we imagine when we look at these maps? Well,
certainly not an empty world. It was a world, Massachusetts was chosen by the Massachusetts Bay Company, whose investors came from other colonial companies at work in England at the time. And they had experienced the fisheries on the northern banks. So they knew that the New England coast was full of wood, but also full of rivers. And on the rivers were marshland and grassland, on which they immediately began raising cattle for survival and also for trade, salt meat and cattle hides that, you know, a lot of ships were happy to find when they stopped over. So imagine a world that to the English looked very much like England, because it combined plain land with mountains, woodland, and a climate that was definitely colder than England, but had nothing of the seasoning that had given Virginia such a bad reputation. The colder weather meant fewer diseases. So imagine a world where there are woods, cleared land, Indian or indigenous farmland that the English weren't always apt at seeing or discovering, but they were very good at finding corn stalks to steal from in the early days. But it is a world that is between land and sea. The colonists rely on water for trade, for communication, for food. So they settle in various points across the bay at the mouths of the many rivers of the bay to capture the beaver trade that will be traveling down these rivers, but also to have a point of access to the interior where settlements can continue to progress along the banks of the river. So it's a very utilitarian view of the landscape, which is, you know, the spread out settlement in crucial access points that are going to make trade and agriculture possible in the quickest possible way. So
what kind of population can we imagine? You said 20,000 came over the course of the decade, but I'm guessing that's for the entire New World possessions of England. How many people might have lived in the Massachusetts Bay Colony?
At what point?
Let's say 1635 or something.
1635, you would have expected between 8,000 and 10,000 people. That's a lot. And that's a lot of people gathered, again, across a vast territory. They come in on various ships, and then when they get to the land, they undergo what historians have called the Great Reshuffling. That is, they organize themselves into groups by family groups or regional affiliation or Puritan beliefs. Some are keener to follow the teaching of one minister over another, and that will be the reason why they'll go to that town instead of that town. And very quickly, they are given land. Surveyors are a very important part of land management in Massachusetts. Plots of land on which they are obliged to work immediately or within 3 years. If within 3 years they haven't farmed the land that the corporation has given them, they lose it. So they come over and they cut down trees and they plant corn, or they raise cattle if they are very closer to the grassland of the riverbanks. They plant orchards. They have a lot of hogs as well. So they combine subsistence agriculture with cattle raising in order to generate a little bit of surplus that circulates across the bay. What fascinated me in particular was how sophisticated the magistrates were in thinking about infrastructure. That they were very quickly market towns and market days registered in the minutes of the corporation, that the corporation paid for boats to connect various points around the bay. There was a real awareness on their part that people should be connected in some way and circulate between settlements in order to exchange their goods, but also maybe communicate or visit families. So imagine a landscape dotted with villages that do not look like the New England village that we imagine. We imagine the white steeple and a few houses in the middle surrounded by woodland. It's not really what New England towns look like. They certainly have a core, and the core is the meeting house, which is, it is the church, but it's also the place of social and political interaction, a market possibly on certain days, and a first circle of habitations around that meeting house, which will combine ownership by the richer colonists, the leaders of each town, but also poor farmers who live near the center to have access to communal fields and wood. But then each town was about 6 miles, 6 square miles, which is quite a vast territory. So there are other circles, outer circles, where younger farmers, maybe poorer farmers, live and raise cattle or grain in as tenants to other landowners. And little by little, land is cleared between those outer farms and the inner farms. And that's how these settlements over time will connect into one territory. But it will never be just one settler territory. There are native villages and native communities that continue to reside in that land and to interact with settlers as well. It is what historians have called a hybrid land.
Hybrid land. Yes. Would you tell us about the native villages and the inclusion of indigenous American Indians, and also their dispossession and exploitation, and just how that changed over the course of the decade? And you write there was never any peace in New England, but a continuous process of rumors, intimidation, conflicts, and negotiation, which Winthrop navigated with unwavering confidence in his own racial superiority. And, would you tell us how this played out?
Well, this is a great question. It's a very, very difficult one for many reasons. First, a little caveat or disclaimer. I am French. And I've always understood that doing indigenous history itself was beyond my capabilities because I don't speak any indigenous languages and I have no connection or not even proximity with indigenous communities or historians who are at present doing amazing work, resurrecting a past that has been negated by the dominance of Eurocentric views of what happened on the ground. Violence, I think, in New England was an integral part of the settlers' lives for many reasons. First, colonization is violence. Appropriating land that doesn't belong to you is a form of violence. The settlers also incorporated indigenous children and women in particular into their households and giving them new names and new identities and also forbidding that they should maintain kinship ties with their kin and their tribes in the West. As settlement progressed, the population increased and more land was needed. Because the business model of the Massachusetts Bay Company included cattle, the settlers had their eyes on rivers along the Long Island Sound, and in particular the Connecticut River, which marked sort of the western limit of what the founding charter of 1629 gave them as territory. So from the mid-1630s, they are already busy trying to build trading forts and smaller settlements on the Connecticut River. So they travel mostly by sea, but Winthrop is very clear that the point in the end is to have contiguous settlement from Massachusetts Bay all the way to Connecticut. And that means running across Narragansett territory, Niantic territory, Nipmuc territory, and the Massachusetts as well. So the plan is always for expansion. And the manner with which this expansion happened becomes always more violent throughout the decade until the years 1637-38 and what is known as the Pequot War, which was basically a series of military expeditions on behalf of the Massachusetts Bay Company to inflict, and the term is theirs, inflict terror upon indigenous peoples residing in those areas to make them run away. So there are instances of armed conflicts, isolated armed conflicts between individual towns or planters and their indigenous neighbors. And there is, in the mid-1630s, this massive campaign of terror against indigenous peoples in the region. That is the beginning also of the use of slavery, indigenous slavery, and which I believe increased the degree of violence greatly in the settlement. You know, marking Indian bodies, separating families, selling people off to regions that were very distant and from which they did not expect them to return. So the brutality of slavery that we think of mostly in the southern colonies was also at work in New England from very, very early on. So this is what I mean by no peace in New England. Expansion was always going to continue, and violence was the daily lot of settlers because their very act of appropriation, colonization, was itself a violent act.
And this is the, may I ask, this is the very beginning of Atlantic slavery. And when Henry Winthrop was in Barbados, it sounds to me when he was planting those failed tobacco fields, he didn't have slaves yet, right? But here you tell us Indian women and children were sold to Bermuda, which shocks me again, because you would think women and children wouldn't be able to do that tropical, that forced labor. Could you describe what this slavery looked like, if you can?
Well, I can. These captives were war loot. They were from what the letters of the settlers and Winthrop's narrative. The policy was to, if possible, kill Indian warriors, and there are very gruesome passages where pieces of men's bodies, scalps, and ears are circulated across the settlement as proof of their death. So the idea of killing warriors is, of course, to dismantle and to jeopardize indigenous alliances at work in the region. That's what happens with men mostly. Women and children become captive in this just war, this war of conquest that the settlers call just war. And they are, for many, incorporated into settler households where there's always a great need for additional labor, or sold abroad as a way to empty villages, simply empty villages for more land for Europeans to settle on. It sounds very brutal, but it is in the text, and it is very much what Winthrop describes. I think my second chapter on the Pilgrims also demonstrates that this was the way colonization was envisaged by the English when they decided to settle. There was always that fear, rumor, you know, a sort of doubt as to the legitimacy of their land occupation, because they're scared. And there are rumors circulating all the time about how the Indians want to kill them all. How they're always in danger. So they proceed by inversion. They negate the violence of their own actions, which is to come in, steal corn, occupy Indian farmland because it's already partly cleared, letting their hogs roam the countryside and destroy Indian crops, which leads to famine and weakness among these people, these indigenous people. And there is this strategy of slow encroachment onto indigenous land that they justify as self-defense. So the rumors are here to explain why they used weapons. That's in the narratives. Now in the letters that they exchange, the policy is very simple. It's acquisitiveness, so capture bodies, use them as laborers or sell them for profit, and destroy villages because they're simply in the way. And that's in the sources, and it's sometimes difficult to read, but I think it's important to understand that it happened. Now, because, you know, nothing is worse than war or terror or locking people into a fort and setting it on fire. But the violence that Winthrop exerts, he's no warlord and he's no soldier. He's a lawyer, and he believes in constitutionality and the law. And his way of justifying this colonizing policy is simply to silence indigenous agency. He does not, he describes sachems who come to Boston to negotiate treaties and ownership with him in a very stereotypical monolithic manner. They are Indians, therefore they're always the same. They are lazy, they're mischievous. Sometimes they're reliable if it's useful, but you know, he resorts to a lot of racial stereotypes. He abides by a very strong racialized view of how the land should be his, and therefore these people should go.
Yeah, and I think that also shows their humanity in his eyes, doesn't it? That he needs them to submit and to surrender. There's passages of, you know, some, I forgot which leader it was, but he places Winthrop's hand on his heart and says, "This heart is your heart, and my men are your men." And
There's always the question of veracity. You see, the whole point of focusing on promotion was to say, if colonization is a public act, this record of events, is it a truthful record, or does it serve a particular purpose, which is to defend a form of land occupation that was unprecedented, remarkably violent, and that needed to be accounted for abroad in England, but also in other areas of Atlantic colonization. So I think that public dimension of promotion forces us to doubt pretty much every statement that Winthrop makes. But to read his statements with as in mind the corporate structure he was working within and the commission that he valued so much once he was elected to the company. And that commission required that he pursued the interests of the corporation. And the interests of the corporation were sustainability, solvency, and always more land. And that necessarily came into conflict with, you know, the interests of the French in the north, the Dutch in the south, also the pilgrims to a certain extent, and most importantly, indigenous peoples. I think that's why Richard Dunn, who's worked so much on John Winthrop, has this wonderful phrase. He says, well, for some of us, John Winthrop is one of the great figures of American history, but for others, quote, he is the man you love to hate, unquote. And I think it's true, the vindictiveness and the brutality of his speech and his writing sometimes is very astounding. And to me, it testifies of his sense of scientificity, his awareness that what was happening in New England was simply a new form of collective political existence that was English in origin, but belonged to a space that was completely new. And that justified that they invented so many rules of demeanor and behavior, etc. So I think that's why I find him fascinating. The fact that he knew that colonization was only at its beginning and that settlement within the wider methods of colonizing that Europeans were practicing was particular and was unique.
Well, I agree that everything he has written, especially on the subject of the native peoples, was for the consumption of his investors back home, or I should say back across the ocean, not back home. But for example, the seal of the Massachusetts Bay Company, which has an Indian man pointing his bow toward the ground in peace and standing between two trees, you write, as if it were a gate to a land of resources, and a little speech bubble coming out of his mouth saying, come and help us, or something like that. It's not that they thought the indigenous people were animals. They had to tell a story where they were saving the poor benighted savages from themselves, even as they knew that they were killing and terrorizing, your quotation of terror, and selling them off. That for me is very interesting, especially how steeped this writing is in the gospel and in the city on a hill, that he could hold both of those at the same time in his rhetoric and in his imagination.
Well, that's where the expression the good land comes from the Bible, of course, Numbers and Deuteronomy. And it is the land of promise. It's Canaan, the land that God promises to his people. And the Puritans weren't the first and the only ones to use this formulation. Religious exceptionalism was at work in Spanish colonization as well. Every European nation claimed to own true religion and to be able to save the indigenous or the native peoples from obscurity and damnation by converting them. So this was, to me, this was really a trope of promotional literature that was shared across many nations, European nations colonizing in the Americas at the time.
I suppose we should add that this is exactly at the time of the 30 Years' War, where Europeans were equally happy to murder other Europeans in extraordinary numbers. I think something like a third of Central Europe was wiped out between Protestants and Catholics, and often Protestants and Catholics united against other Protestants and Catholics. So it's not reserved for indigenous populations.
Yes, and there isn't one way of looking at appropriation. There isn't one uniform view of indigenous peoples. There are actually competing visions. Winthrop himself could, in one letter or pamphlet, talk about America as a vacuum domicili, as an empty land, where there were no people, when obviously that was completely untrue, and he knew it. So in other times, Native Americans are used as foils, pushing forward the narrative and the action towards the success of the business. If we remember that colonization is a public act and a commercial enterprise, then we can accommodate these different versions because colonizers did not encounter the same populations every time, and political alliances also shifted in America as time went on. So instead of having one monolithic view of the Puritan errand as one goal, and it's interesting, it's more interesting to me to think of this as what Elizabeth Menke calls spaces of power. So think of it as spaces that are shared, are contested by many actors with various interests. And it's not as grand as the sweeping march forward of American liberty, but it's also, it's much more interesting in terms of experience, diversity, hybridity, and also the imagination, because I got to discover and imagine. We have to realize we have no visual representation of colonial America, or very few. The first engravings describing the cities date from the 1740s, 1750s. Before that, we have no actual images of what the landscape looked like, what the towns looked like, or what the daily existence of the colonists felt like to them. And I think by looking at space rather than ideas, conflict and contestation rather than the inevitable conquest of or march of American liberty over the land, we discover varieties of experiences, those of indigenous people, of course, but also women. We hear very little about them. I think in the future there'll be much more research about how women understood their role in the colonizing process, because I'm sure you've noticed by reading my book how much masculinity figures very strongly in Winthrop's self-perception, because competency was a masculine goal for the gentry, you know, independence from a father or a father-in-law or an aristocrat was a form of manhood. In order to reach manhood, you had to become independent. And that is very much in Winthrop's writing throughout his entire career.
And I noticed that the role of women, at least in the religious or the view in your chapter on liberty, is just for procreation, right? It's it's another form of expansion, just like more land. It's more people. And that the sexual crimes that that resulted in conception were often not punished. And the sexual crimes that did not, especially homosexual crimes and things like that, were punished severely.
Absolutely. So what is land if it's empty? The point of traveling over and conquering it is to fill it with people and villages and fields and cows and, you know, occupy it, really, a form of occupation. And for that, you need children and large families. Winthrop himself had many, many children, even though he lost many. And he was a very devoted family man. I mean, we shouldn't just imagine the horrible Puritan tyrant who is so repressed and, you know, had no ability for fun or sensuality. I think that doesn't apply to him. He loves marriage. He loves the company of his wife. He enjoys the physicality of marriage as well. But he really believes that that marriage serves one purpose, which is to grow, to have children, and acquire more land to keep in the family. So the size of land of the holding and the size of the family kind of go together. And I think that's something that settler colonial scholars will recognize. Settler societies dedicate a lot of their attention to the health of the family.
I think that is a great place to stop. And I want to Thank you again. And just tell our listeners that Settling the Good Land is published by Brill, and it's very easy for the non-specialist to read, extremely accessible, a very quick 300 pages with lots of colorful maps and just a magisterial and a supremely engaging work. So Dr. Delahaye, thank you so much for speaking with us this morning.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.